Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details. Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There is a difference between the story the world sees and the one that gets lived behind closed doors. And when you talk about the Alec Murtaugh case, that divide is wider than most people realize. We've heard the prosecutors, we've heard the defense, we've heard experts and commentators and internet sleuths, but the person we didn't hear from in detail until now is the one who saw the family the way they actually were, not the way they appeared in the courtroom or the headlines. Not the curated public version of Southern legacy, power and charm. But the real family, the day-to-day habits, the unguarded moments, the messes, the routines, the spilled milk, the hugs, the love, the laughter, the screaming, the shouting, the whatever may have been going on in that house at Moselle. Blanca Simpson wasn't a spectator. She lived inside their patterns for more than a decade. And that gives her memoir a kind of emotional authority that no investigator or attorney can replicate. It's not about legal arguments. It's about lived truth. The small human details she never forgot because they were part of her everyday job. The things she noticed because she was the one who had to put them back into place. She enters this story not as a whistleblower, not as someone suspicious of Alex, but as someone who liked him, trusted him. He had hired her, embraced her as part of the household, treated her well, and relied on her for everything from laundry to translating for Spanish-speaking clients. She cared for the Murtaughs the way you care for a family you see every week, sometimes every day, and her affection for Maggie was real. Her warmth towards Paul was real. That's the foundation she starts from. And that's what makes what comes next so painful. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube as we go through this. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You'll find us. And hit subscribe, too, while you're at it. No matter what platform, if you're on Apple Podcasts, if you're on Spotify, if you're on YouTube, whatever it may be, hit subscribe, please, so you don't miss any of our commentaries on the many cases that we cover here for you every single day. Please do hit subscribe. She remembers June 7th of 2021 like a split screen in her mind. That morning, she worked through her casual checklist, washed dishes, straightened surfaces, handled laundry, folded the Adesto Beach towel she put on the top shelf. She remembers the quiet, the normal, the hum of routine that she had lived for years. When news broke that night, none of it felt real. And when Alec called her the next morning, his voice shaking, telling her, "They're gone." That's my best Alec Murtaugh. She had no space in her mind where Alec was the killer. Her instinct was to help, to comfort, to assist, to straighten the house for visitors, just as she had. She describes getting into her car, driving towards Moselle with dread in her chest, but still genuinely believing someone else had done this. Someone with a grudge against Paul. Someone connected to the boat crash. Someone out for revenge. That was a story she clung to because it was the only one she could live with at that moment. But the house wouldn't let her keep that story. The moment she walked inside Moselle, she felt something was wrong. Not in an abstract way, but in the concrete, tactile language only a housekeeper understands. The first thing? Maggie's Mercedes, she says, parked in the wrong spot. And not just different, but wrong. The kind of wrong that jumps out only to someone who has watched a person pull in and out of the same places for years. That detail bothered her instantly. Maggie wasn't casual about parking. She placed things where they belonged. She had a pattern, a routine. And this wasn't it. Then the laundry room. She sees pajamas laid out on the floor as if someone wanted the scene to suggest that Maggie had planned to sleep there. Except Blanca knew Maggie. She knew where Maggie kept her nighttime clothes. She knew Maggie didn't lay them out like that. She knew Maggie didn't sleep at Moselle unless she had a reason. She knew with absolute certainty that Maggie didn't wear underwear to bed. The underwear on the floor looked staged, not lived in. It's a particular kind of silence you experience when a detail hits you in the gut before your brain catches up. That's what she describes. A still point in the room where everything feels arranged and not natural. The kitchen was the next punch, she alleges. Blanca knew Maggie's rhythms after dinner. Maggie cooked, but she didn't deep clean the same night. The pots would still be out the next morning, sometimes soaked, sometimes sitting off to the side. The routine was predictable in its imperfections, but that morning, the kitchen was cleaned in a way that felt like someone trying too hard to erase evidence of normal life. She didn't jump to accusations. Instead, she cataloged these wrongnesses in her mind, one by one, unsure what to make of them. But even with all of the off-kilter details piling up, she kept insisting to herself that it couldn't have been Alex. She wasn't ready to let go of the version of him that she knew. And then August came. This is the moment in the book where her loyalty takes its first real hit. Alec calls her over, sits her down, and starts talking about his clothes on the day of the murders. Not casually, not as a response to a question. He instructs her, "You remember what I was wearing that day?" I'm going to be Alec, I guess, as we go through this. That's how the script strikes me. He emphasizes the Vineyard Vines shirt. He pushes her to agree. He does it with confidence, as if stating it hard will make it true. Except it wasn't true. According to her, she knew the shirt. She had straightened the collar. It was not Vineyard Vines. And the more he insisted, the colder she felt, because this wasn't just a memory conflict. It was someone trying to convince her of a reality she hadn't lived. And that shirt, just like the one he wore earlier in the Snapchat video with Paul, was never seen again. It was gone, absorbed into the vacuum of missing items that matched only one scenario. Someone got rid of them. But even then, Blanca still held on to hope that maybe she was overthinking things. Maybe grief was distorting her perceptions. Maybe there was another explanation for the inconsistencies. Then she watched the police body cam footage. She described sitting in front of that screen, not expecting any new revelation. She had seen crime scene footage before, courtroom footage, photographs, but nothing prepared her for the blast of recognition when she saw that Edesto Beach towel sitting on the front seat of Alex's Suburban. The same towel she had folded that morning, placed high on a shelf in the laundry room, a shelf that wasn't casually accessed, especially not on a day when Maggie and Paul wound up murdered at the Kettles. She didn't need to stretch to make connections. For her, the towel was a missing hinge that closed the door. She believed he had hosed himself off, near the kennels, something police had noted as possibly based on water patterns. She believed he walked into the laundry room dripping, grabbed the towel she had folded hours earlier, maybe grabbed a clean shirt hanging there and used both in his cleanup. Then disposed of them. Both disappeared. No trace, no explanation that matched innocence. That was the moment she whispered, Oh my God, he did it. But the book doesn't stop there. She struggles with something deeper. The emotional violence of the aftermath, the fact that Maggie was left out there in the dark. Blanca talks about how Maggie was terrified of the dark, hated being outside alone at night, avoided walking the property after sundown. She knew Maggie's fears immediately and intimately. The image of Maggie's body lying out there under floodlights, surrounded by insects, animals, cold air. With her life violently taken, that image lives inside Blanca's mind in a way she cannot shake. Not as evidence, but as heartbreak. There's another detail she doesn't emphasize for drama, but for honesty. Paul. She describes Paul with a kind of affectionate clarity. His humor, his impulsiveness, his boyish warmth. He wasn't perfect, but he was loved. She knew the sound of his laugh, the way he moved through a room, the way he interacted with his mother, and she can't reconcile that familiarity with the brutality of how he died. Her memoir includes the unsent letter she wrote to Alec. It's sharp, it's pained, it's a woman trying to pry her memories apart and salvage what's left. In the letter, she tells him he had the world, power, name, family, legacy, and wasted all of it. She talks about the betrayal, not in legal terms, but in personal terms. How do you work in a man's home for over a decade? Watch him joke with his family. Watch him wrap gifts, plan dinners, give advice to clients. And then accept that he murdered the people he claimed to love most. That's the fracture she's writing from. It's not easy. It's not clean. It's not triumphant. It's grief wrapped in clarity. She also shares pieces of Maggie most people never knew. The way she talked, the way she kept her home, the way she protected her sons, the way she moved through her routines. The book is as much a tribute as it is a testimony. Blanca isn't writing to sensationalize. She's writing to reclaim Maggie from the headlines, to push back against the flattening the true crime world tends to do. And when she talks about the trial, she zeroes in on the video that ultimately removed all remaining doubt for most. Paul's final cell phone clip at the kennels, that Snapchat video. That moment when Alec's voice is unmistakably in the background. She remembers hearing it for the first time and feeling something inside her collapse. She knew that voice. She'd heard it call out from the driveway, from the kitchen, from across the room. It was him at the kennels. At the exact moment he always claimed he wasn't. For Blanca, that was the confirmation of what her instincts had been screaming since the towel, the staging, the shirt, the inconsistencies, the way he tried to overwrite her memory, the details she found that he pretended not to notice. Everything aligned around one truth she no longer had the luxury of denying. And that's why her book hits so hard. It's not written like an accusation. It's written like a goodbye to Maggie, to Paul, to her own innocence about who Alec was, and to the version of her life she believed she was part of. There's no joy in realizing someone you trusted committed the worst possible crimes. There is only the slow unraveling of what you thought you knew. Blanca's story is the story of someone forced to revisit every moment, every conversation, every routine, and reinterpret it through a new, horrifying lens. That's the story of a woman realizing the man she once defended, the man she once thought was grieving, was actually trying to shape her into a witness who would remember things his way. And in the end, that's the part that lingers. Not the evidence itself, not the court case, not the verdict, but the betrayal, the quiet, subtle, domestic betrayal of trust that only someone inside the house would ever feel to this degree. Her story doesn't try to solve the case. It simply tells the truth. She lived. And that truth when she finally allowed herself to see it, was unavoidable. It's a very interesting book from a new perspective on this case, and it reveals some pieces that we did not hear in court, that never made it into evidence, it never made it into testimony. That I would say, in my opinion, certainly does point to his guilt. Certainly does point to his guilt. It certainly points to at least a cover-up, at the very least. Did he do it? Did he know who did it? Did he have something to do with it? I'm over there. If like this is, he did it without a doubt. This is completely innocent. This is, I don't know. I'm over here. Not quite all the way here, but I'm over here. It's really hard to try and intermingle the idea that there's someone else involved in this. And there's no evidence of it. Nobody's come forward. There's nothing, not even a inkling of anyone even being suggested as being part of this, other than boogeymen of someone that didn't like Paul. Which may be the case, and someone got away with a perfect crime and Alec is the perfect scapegoat for. Are there something greater at play here? Or it was the mind of a drug-riddled, maniacal, malignant narcissist that ultimately put his ego and his own self-image, his own protection of his self-image, above the lives of his son and his wife. Two people that he knew could take him down or were actively taking him down, and not even by choice. Paul's actions created the cascade effect, the domino effect that was exposing his financial truths, his crimes. And he continued to be an F-up. Creates tension, without a doubt. Should you ever have any desire to kill your child, no matter what they do? No, but you can certainly be angry. To be angry at himself, that his own crimes are being exposed, but that's not how narcissists work. It's somebody else's fault. If you hadn't done that, you wouldn't make me do this. And he had a wife that was ready to leave. A wife who also could expose quite a bit to get what she needed in a divorce, especially when there might not be much left. And then you mix in the opioid addiction, which is going to make you make very bad choices very quickly. And if you take a bit too many at any given time, well, you might not be in your right mind. Do I think Alec Murdaugh killed his family, or would have killed his family had the opioids not been part of the equation? I don't think so. But you add that in, and you add in the narcissistic thinking and the ultimate need for image preservation, which will win no matter what. I always say, narcissism always wins. Not the narcissist. They're simply like a vehicle for the narcissism. If you want to view it as like a bug or a virus that attaches onto something, kills its host, and moves on to the next. I mean, that's not what it is, but for the sake of the analogy, the narcissism that a narcissist chooses to live by will kill them. It will always take them down. It will always destroy them. If you go down that path, it will destroy you. You don't have to jump onto the narcissist's train and help them dig their hole. They will do it. And they will do it happily, not even knowing it. And is this just another case of that? The narcissism mixed with the prescription drugs won. It made Alec do something absolutely horrible that he can't take back, that he can't even contemplate that he did. And then try to cover it up. Or did some magic person sneak in there in just the right amount of time, kill them, and get out? Perfect timing. Or did Alec know somebody to do this job for him? But that requires a lot of forethought, a lot of planning. And again, when you mix the drugs and stuff in there, it gets a little too strategic for an opioid addict, quite honestly. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Tell me in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That's where you will find us. Do that same search wherever you're listening to the podcast. And wherever you're at, press subscribe. Please hit the button right now so you don't miss any of our commentary, our coverage, our interviews, our discussions on all of these cases. If you're new here, welcome. We appreciate you being here, and we want to hear your voice in those comments on YouTube. So please do check that out, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, if you're not already there. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi, and we will talk again.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.